From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the last few years, a wave of new laws has been taking effect across the country. There are different versions of this legislation, but most of the laws make it illegal to covertly videotape on farms. The idea is to make it a crime for undercover journalists or activists to film in places like slaughterhouses. 5 states have passed the laws recently, including Utah. 6 others are considering them. The food writer Mark Bittman coined the term ag gag to describe the legislation. Those who favor the law say the images of cruelty and animal abuse are isolated incidents and taken out of context. Opponents say these images have inspired criminal investigations, and they say the laws violate free speech and isolate consumers. Today in the program, we're exploring these laws, and we hope you'll join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2012, Utah lawmakers approved a piece of legislation that outlaws agricultural operation interference. That's the term in the law. Here's what it means. It's a crime to photograph or videotape under false pretenses or without permission the practices inside a farming operation. Utah is only one state in the country which has passed laws like this over the last few years. Iowa has, so has Missouri, Tennessee, Arkansas, and at least 6 others are debating similar measures. But Utah's law came into the spotlight recently when a woman, Amy Meyer, was charged for using her cell phone to film the operations at a farm in Draper. Charges were ultimately dropped. Turns out she was on public property at the time. But the case has raised questions about these laws and about the practices they're designed to prevent. The food writer Mark Bittman coined the term ag gag to describe the legislation. Those who favor the laws say the images of cruelty and animal abuse are isolated incidents and taken out of context, and that these laws protect privacy. Opponents of ag gag laws say images like these have inspired criminal investigations and food recalls, and they say the laws violate free speech and isolate consumers from the reality of industrial food production. Today in the program, we're talking about these so-called ag gag laws, and we invite you to join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Joining us first on the program is Will Potter. He's an independent journalist who covers animal rights, environmental movements, and civil liberties. His writing has appeared in the LA Times, in Rolling Stone, in Mother Jones magazine. He's the author of the book Green is the New Red, an insider's account of social movements under siege. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. And Will Potter, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start by giving us a sense of it seems like these kinds of laws have come in kind of waves, and it seems like the Utah law can be counted in the most recent wave. Give us a sense of what it is that inspired this legislation that's being considered and has been passed recently in the United States.
I think this recent wave was really inspired by a series of high-profile undercover investigations by groups like Mercy for Animals and the Humane Society, PETA, Compassion Over Killing, and they were exposing aberrant behavior, criminal behavior, but also systemic animal welfare abuses on factory farms and slaughterhouses. And with each of these investigations, they got national and international media exposure. They used them to help introduce ballot initiatives around the country trying to outlaw some of the most egregious practices. And they really, in my opinion, the last couple of years began to change the national dialogue about food and about animal welfare and environmental issues. And I think that really dovetails with the rise of these ag gag bills in the last couple of years in an attempt to, rather than change the practice, to outlaw people who are exposing it.
I want to get a sense of the idea of what constitutes abuse, what constitutes something that might be illegal. Because Mark Bittman, I mentioned him in the introduction, he also says this. He's written that the biggest problem of all is that we've created, he says, a system in which standard factory farming practices are inhumane. So how do you make a distinction between what might be inhumane and cruel and an abuse and what is just going on all of the time in factory farms?
And to me, that's at the center of this debate.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not really just talking about things like in North Carolina, where workers were exposed beating turkeys with metal pipes, or in Wyoming, where they were slamming piglets to death on concrete floors. Those things are horrific, and they certainly happen. But Bittman is absolutely right that the reason these investigations are being targeted so fiercely by the industry is that they're exposing what's normal. And I think most Americans have absolutely no idea what is completely normal in modern agriculture. I mean, things like debeaking and docking piglets' tails, keeping pigs in gestation crates, keeping birds in cages so they can never even turn around their entire lives. I mean, these things are standard industry practices. And that's really at the center of the debate. So when you have the industry say things like, well, these investigations, they're not showing anything. They're just showing they're not illegal activity. This is just all normal. They're telling the truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the center argument here is, should this be normal?
You know, this gets at a question that you hear from food industry spokespeople and supporters supporters of these kinds of laws is that the thing that is motivating laws like this or criticism of laws like this is this essential idea that not to just clean up the practices, but to do away with the modern meat production, with, you know, these are a bunch of, you know, vegans or animal rights activists who are trying to completely discredit any kind of meat production. So I wanted to get your sense of that, your response to that idea, that that's the thing that's motivating it.
Well, for the first part of it, the opposition simply isn't true in saying that this is coming from this kind of extremist animal rights agenda. I mean, the Teamsters are not extremist animal rights activists. Neither are the ACLU or the Government Accountability Project, the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. These are all groups that have come out and fiercely fought these ag bills around the country. It's been a really diverse coalition of groups that, frankly, in my years of reporting on these issues, I've never seen all working on the same page against these bills. But I mean, there is a grain of truth to what the industry is saying, in that some of the animal advocacy groups are pushing for vegetarian and vegan diets. I mean, that is part of their solution.
Right.
But what is left out is that a big part of their solution is also just outlawing the most egregious abuses. And that's something the industry opposes as well. So in California and Florida and New Jersey and Vermont, things like gestation crates are being fought tooth and nail by the industry, who refuses to make even modest concessions in the name of improving animal welfare standards.
I should mention, and maybe you know this, but we just got word that Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam has vetoed his state's ag-gag bill. It happened about an hour ago. He apparently cited last week's legal opinion in from the Tennessee Attorney General, who said the bill's provisions are constitutionally suspect. How do you react to that? And again, because this is another dynamic of these kinds of laws, that they restrict freedom of speech.
I thought Haslam's statement was fantastic. I mean, the pressure has been on him quite a bit in the last few weeks. I just saw the statement as I was walking out the door over to the studio here. But one interesting thing that I was really glad he brought up in that brief statement was about how this Tennessee bill, if passed, would undercut the existing shield law in the state that is intended to protect journalists. And I think that's something that's really central to this debate that's been ignored for the most part, is we're not just talking about undercover investigations by animal groups, and we're also not just talking about journalists. We're also talking about workers, whistleblowers. That's why the unions are on board opposing this as well. I mean, this really is an attack on First Amendment rights from a diversity of groups, and not just activists or even investigative journalists.
Talk about, Will Potter, if you would, the role of the American Legislative Exchange Council. This is this business advocacy group that have as members a lot of state representatives from around the country. What role have they played in crafting this kind of legislation in states like Utah?
Well, Alex's fingerprints are clearly there with these ag-gag bills in a couple of ways. First of all, there's a model legislation, which for your listeners, if you don't know, this is really how Alex operates. They take thousands of dollars from corporations, and in exchange for that money, corporations are allowed to literally draft model legislation that's introduced around the country, in many cases with lawmakers having absolutely no idea where these bills actually came from. And so ALEC has model union-busting legislation that we saw in Wisconsin, the Stand Your Ground bills we saw in Florida, and also a model Animal and Ecological Terrorism Act. And this model bill is so broad that it classifies nonviolent civil disobedience as terrorism. It also creates an eco-terrorist registry, which is a lot like a sex offender registry, except for people who have been arrested for protest and environmental activism. And this bill also includes provisions that are identical to these ag gag bills. Now, with some of the recent bills, they're not verbatim from ALEC's model legislation. Things are tweaked and move around. Sometimes the language isn't identical any longer as these tactics begin to evolve in the last several months and even in the last year. But the links are clearly there. And you also mentioned ALEC's member lawmakers, and that's really important to understanding how this works as well, because these lawmakers around the country, they don't have to disclose their ALEC affiliation. And ALEC, on its websites and in its internal documents, really prides itself on mobilizing members. So what we have here is a, you know, kind of a bill factory that's producing this model corporate drafted legislation. And then you have this secretive mechanisms of mobilizing lawmakers around the country to help get these passed.
I want to ask about the bigger history, the longer history here, because you've mentioned in the past that there's a long history of investigative journalism related to this kind of thing. You mentioned Nellie Bly. I heard you mention that, for example, once, who exposed abuses in public mental institutions, for example. That there's and this seems to be the kind of tradition that you worry about in terms of being affected by laws like this.
Absolutely. I mean, I would even extend that to people like Jonathan Safran Foer. In his book, Eating Animals, he has a chapter in which he doesn't go undercover and doesn't seek employment. He straight up trespasses. He goes out with, he doesn't even identify who this is. He says she's a local activist, and they trespass onto this property because he wants to see for himself. I mean, he's writing an entire book about the consumption of animal products in these industries. All of his attempts to see these places on legal terms was denied. So he trespasses. And that obviously could be wrapped up in these undercover ag gag bills. There are also examples like, people who are not necessarily misrepresenting themselves in employment applications, but are not being 100% forthcoming. For instance, they're obtaining employment lawfully. They're not lying on any of their applications, but they're also not saying that they intend to write a magazine article about this or to produce a video documentary or anything like that. So this is the type of First Amendment area that I think these ag gags are really treading upon, because the industry is posing as if these are attempts to go after people who are breaking the law, misrepresenting themselves, trying to smear the industry, and that's simply not the case. These also wrap up people who are just trying to expose what consumers are purchasing.
It's interesting what seems to be the effect of 9/11 on the way we talk about this, the terms that we use, and even the activities of certain animal rights groups. I mean, one activist had mentioned in a piece I saw that after 9/11, they had softened their tactics because there's been this kind of very sensitive reaction to this idea of terrorism. And I'm wondering, even the term itself, what are you seeing in that way, in the way that term is being used in this context?
Well, you know, this really stretches back to the early 1980s. Industry groups were the ones who created this term eco-terrorism. I mean, they made it up. And they made up this specialized idea of terrorism because at the time, calling animal rights and environmental activism just terrorism, and straightforwardly like that, wasn't very well received in the public. So this was really the emergence of a new type of language that was being used. And like you said, after 9/11, in some ways, activists pulled back on their tactics, but industry escalated theirs. We started seeing this terrorism rhetoric appear much more frequently and fluidly. You know, it used to be confined, for the most part in my research, to underground groups like the Animal Liberation Front or Earth Liberation Front. And although those groups have never harmed a human being, they've certainly broken the law and in some cases been involved in extreme property crimes like arson, destroying SUVs, stealing animals from laboratories. But what we've seen in the last couple of years is something that when I first started working on these issues, I really never would have thought possible. And that's using this terrorism rhetoric against groups that are simply exposing through photographs and through videotape what's taking place on factory farms and slaughterhouses. I think this is an escalation of this type of tactic in a way that we've never seen before. And legislators are using this language. As they introduce the bill, some of them actually talk about the threat of terrorism by these groups. U.S. members of Congress have talked about the economic terrorism of undercover investigations. I've written about FBI documents that show the FBI has actually considered terrorism prosecutions against undercover investigators. So these aren't just hypothetical or hyperbolic uses of rhetoric by these groups. There's actually a very real concern here.
There was I took note of this change in 2006. There used to be what is called the Animal Enterprise Protections Act. And it was changed in 2006 to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. I guess this is an example of again, changing the rhetoric, I suppose.
An example of that, and also, I think, more importantly, an example of the theatrical nature of all of this. I mean, the changes that were made to that law were severe. I mean, I testified against it before the House Judiciary Committee and raised concerns as a journalist, much of exactly what we're talking about today, about how it can be used against undercover investigators and whistleblowers. But really, the true motivation for those hearings was this nature of the spectacle, of creating this spectacle investigating the animal rights terrorists. And once you have that aura and have this rhetoric that's being thrown around, it really facilitates these types of crackdowns and facilitates new legislation being introduced around the country. And I think that was really a key stepping stone along this path from, you know, industry groups making up that language, introducing legislation piecemeal over the years, including federal legislation, and now exactly where we're at today with these ag gag bills.
Will Potter is with us. He's a journalist covering animal rights and environmental movements. He's the author of the book Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. Joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about laws designed to keep people from documenting the abuse of farm animals in industrial food production. It's referred to as the Ag Gag Law. A Utah woman was the first person charged with it recently, though those charges were dropped. The idea is to make it a crime for undercover journalists or others to film in places like slaughterhouses. Those who favor these kinds of laws say they protect privacy. Opponents say they violate free speech and isolate consumers from the realities of where your food comes from. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Will Potter is joining us first on the program, a journalist who covers animal rights and environmental movements. And Will Potter, I wanted to ask you about this idea of that you'll hear, and we'll hear it later from another voice in the conversation, but this idea that what you're talking about, this factory farms is a piece of rhetoric. Industrial farms is a piece of propaganda that you hear, that these are in fact small family farms that we're dealing with, and these laws are designed to protect small family farms. React to that, if you would.
it's an interesting attempt to change the rhetoric as these groups are on the defensive. Saying that farms that have tens of thousands of animals are family farms is kind of like saying KFC is a family business because Colonel Sanders has a family. I mean, that's really the logic that's being employed here. These are multinational operations in some cases. When they're not, they're still industrial operations that have thousands of animals confined like any other industry. These animals are treated like widgets or parts on an assembly line. They're not treated as individuals. They're not roaming the countryside in front of little red barns, drinking from ponds, with windmills in the background. That's the kind of imagery I think the industry is really desperately trying to put forward, but it simply does not exist. I think most people are unaware that there are between 8 and 10 billion animals killed every year just in this country alone for food. 8 to 10 billion. That simply those numbers are not possible in the idyllic type of environment that the industry is putting forward here.
Does a farmer, the owner of an operation, put it that way then, have personal property rights? I mean, and what are the limits or extents of those rights? I mean, you hear from, I heard quoted, for example, a spokesman for the American Legislative Exchange Council say, look, you wouldn't want me coming into your home with a hidden camera. So how does that question come into play, this question of personal property rights, privacy rights?
It's a really interesting argument to put forward, too, because we have to remember, it's kind of like saying if someone exposes child abuse or domestic violence in someone's home, that you can respond to that by saying that the person is in the wrong for exposing it. It's an attempt to deflect attention away to what is actually taking place and instead put the person who's exposing it on the defensive. This industry, though, is a bit different than any example like that because you have millions of Americans that are purchasing these products. They're consuming them. There's a public health safety issue that's at stake right here. And there's also an environmental question that's at stake as these factory farms are some of the most polluting in the world. So as we're talking about this right to privacy, we need to throw in for consideration the fact that this is an industry that in some cases has been exposed, putting consumer and children's health at risk. For instance, in California, it led to the largest meat recall in U.S. history. So in my opinion, these arguments about, well, we have a right to do whatever we want because it's our land, just don't hold up.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Don is with us in Ogden, Utah. Don, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I really strongly agree with you. It's not just vegans and wild-eyed vegetarians who want these animals treated better. There's a guy named Adam Richman who does some shows like Amazing Eats on the Travel Channel. And that guy will eat anything. I've seen him eat sheep eyeballs and and all kinds of different meat. And he still feels very strongly that these animals should be treated with respect. And the second part of that is, I don't see how anyone can argue that they have a right to privacy if they can be seen from a public spot. If I open my window and I stand in front of it naked, and you can take my picture from the street, I can be arrested. Am I on the right track with that?
Well, I think that's relevant in the Utah case. Amy Meyer, for example, the charges were dropped, I guess we should say, Will Potter, because, as I referred to earlier, she turned out she was on public property videotaping. But you want to react to that comment, Will Potter?
No, I think that's a great point. I mean, that's certainly the case in the Amy Meyer prosecution, like you mentioned. But with a lot of these ag gag bills, they're not in public places. I mean, these operations are far removed from people that might just be passing by. And they're certainly removed from urban centers and city centers where most of these products are eventually consumed in supermarkets around the country. So it's a little bit of a different situation because not all of these cases are like Utah and the prosecutions moving forward certainly won't be as well. But I think you raised a really important point with the first part of your comment about the true breadth of people that are affected by this. Mm-hmm. And I think if there's really one takeaway from everything I'm saying today is that no matter how you feel about these issues, I think you have a right to know. You have a right to seek out this information, you know, to get on your phone or on your laptop and look at the footage, to read about what's happening, and then to make an informed decision about what's best for you, what's best for the animals and the environment, and what's best for your family. And I think that's a decision everyone has a right to make on their own. The industry doesn't think you have that right, and they don't trust you to make that decision on your own.
Do you think, Will Potter, in some way, industry is protecting people, I'll put it that way, from not just the images of abuse, but the realities of the way it works, that in order to get a ribeye steak, you have to kill an animal. I guess the question is, what are they protecting them from? Not just the abuse, but the realities of it itself. Because it seems like, and you hear these arguments from time to time, American consumers are fairly isolated from this process. So is it just about abuse, or is it just about the realities of the production itself?
Absolutely. I think that really hits on, to me, what is at the root of all of this, because it's not about the instances of abuse. I think the industry itself is very well aware of the fact that, you know, consumers know when you're buying chicken at KFC that it was a chicken. I think we all know that in some abstract sense. I mean, we're not completely dense to this concept. Obviously, it's being marketed as chicken, right? We all understand this. But there's a different level of understanding of connecting that product to where that animal was, how that animal was treated during his or her life, how they were killed. And making that connection, I think some people do it really early on as children. And children, I think, are some of the easiest of, you know, making connections like this about living compassionately. For some of us, it takes a really long time. But when you put those elements together, it really changes, I think, your worldview. And I think that's what I've seen in a lot of my work is we're not just talking about people who are trying to outlaw the worst of the worst abuses. It really is about a rethinking of our relationship with animals. It's a rethinking of our relationship with the natural world. You know, not all advocacy groups and people opposed to ACT-GAG will see it that way, but I think that's really what is motivating the ferocity of this backlash against these tactics.
Don, thanks very much. Back to the phones. Jennifer with us in Vernal, Utah. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I'm afraid that commercial farmers are afraid that consumers are not willing to pay $3 a dozen for free-range eggs if they can get horrible eggs for 98 cents a dozen.
Jennifer, let me jump in because we're running out of time. And it sounds like what you're saying, and Will Potter, let me put this to you, this idea that this question of what it is that the market will bear, that if consumers are demanding cheaper food, that you're going to get abuses like this in a system.
That's a key element to this. You can't have products so cheaply without this industrialization and without these types of abuses. And we were seeing the same thing right now with the increased attention on clothing manufacturing, for example. We don't want to think about everything that's connected to those low prices that, you know, we're paying at the department store. And I think that's really important to consider. I mean, as people are exposed to these issues, I think you have a lot of people that are willing to go vegetarian or vegan. And then other people, like you said, that are grappling with this. They may not want to give up consuming animal products, but they may be willing to pay more to know where their products are coming from. And then other people, you know, are going to just have to stop buying out of economic necessity. And all of those different elements, I think, pose a distinct threat to corporate profits. And I think they're all part of this equation of why ag-gag bills are seen as necessary by the industry.
Here's an email from Scott who writes, I think the thing that scares me the most is it seems an attempt to stop whistleblowers. Also, it seems to be an attempt to silence a voice more than it is to control extremists. He says, I think the people have a duty to keep the society in check using information and other nonviolent means and laws like this. He says, stop that process. To that question, Will Potter, of whistleblowers and what effect that could have on them within this industry.
the people that work in this industry are already some of the most vulnerable populations in the country. In many cases, they're immigrants or don't speak English as their native language. On top of that, many of them are undocumented. If there's already an elevated burden on these individuals in the thoughts of coming forward and exposing abuses, they were really putting themselves and their families and their livelihood on the line. So to threaten whistleblowers in these ways, I think really is an assault on some core democratic values. In addition to that, though, I mean, this expansion that we've been talking about on the program, and the idea that this can wrap up investigators and whistleblowers, it's not stopping there. And I think that's something else people really need to understand. It's not just whistleblowers in factory farms. Some of these new bills are actually crafted in such a way that they include whistleblowers and investigators in all industries. So mining, timber operations, logging, fracking, which has become very controversial, automobile manufacturing, all of that can be wrapped up in some of these new attempts to criminalize whistleblowers and journalists.
Let me ask you this finally, Will Potter. You've talked about the fact that this footage now, and I expect that the emergence of videotapes and conversations on the internet are having a powerful effect on this. And you say it's changed the nature of the public debate. Do you see, where do you think it's headed? What's the evolution of it as you see?
I think these issues really in animal circles, animal protection circles, and also environmental activist circles are at a crossroads in similar ways. I think with the environmental movement, you know, there's this attempt right now to greenwash, to take this interest and passion about environmentalism and to co-opt it into something that can be sold back to consumers in a harmless way that's not really going to threaten business as usual too much. And I would argue we're really seeing the exact same thing happen right now with food issues and animal agriculture. There's an attempt by the industry to treat everything that's being exposed as this aberration. And if people really want to make a difference, they can just buy certain products instead. And I think it's important for people to understand that these terms that are being batted around by the industry, like humane or organic, they don't have any backing behind it. There's no substance to them. It's more greenwashing, but in a new sense in terms of food issues. So I think moving forward, we're going to see more legislation like this. It's undeniable. The Tennessee victory was a huge success, but next legislative session, we're going to have more of these bills coming down the pike. And in addition to that, there's going to be public relations attempts to tell consumers to stop worrying about this, to stop looking at the footage, that just, you know, buy this new product and everything will be okay.
That's Will Potter, journalist covering animal rights and environmental movements. He's the author of the book Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. He joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Will Potter, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about laws. There are a number of them designed to keep people from documenting the abuse of farm animals in industrial food production. Some of the laws have been referred to as ag-gag laws. Those who favor these kinds of laws say they protect privacy and that to some of the images that are coming from undercover activists are taken out of context. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Emily Meredith is joining us now, the communications director for the Animal Agricultural Alliance. It's an advocacy group for the animal agricultural industry based in Washington, D.C. She's joining us by phone from her office there. And Emily Meredith, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start with the motivation for these kinds of videos, because it's something you've raised. You've talked about the fact that the motivation behind all of this isn't about industry practices. It isn't about public health. At least from your perspective, you say a lot of these are designed really to essentially encourage people to stop eating meat. I wanted to give you a chance to talk about that.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. No one in this industry condones any sort of animal abuse, nor wants that to happen. I think that people, there's a big disconnect between people and where their food is coming from. 98.2% of farms in this country are family-owned, which is a statistic I want to get out there right at the onset. In addition, I think it's important for people to know that this country is fed by less than 2% of our population. So obviously, as people have moved into the cities, they rely more and more on that 2% to feed them and to produce their animal products. And what's important to note about those two statistics I just gave you was that these really are family farms. They may feed into larger slaughterhouses or larger companies, but they're on the most basic level, they're family farms. And so not only is any sort of animal abuse bad for business, but it goes against what these people have been raised to do and what many of them have been doing for generations. These farms have been in many people's generations for 6 or 7, generations going back. So really treating your animals with the utmost respect is something that has been ingrained in these people that are working with our animals every day. And these videos that try to make the industry out to be, this abusive factory farming world are just very disingenuous. And these videos are being promulgated by activist groups really seeking to bring about the end of animal agriculture and the end of the consumption of meat, milk, and eggs in this country. And these videos are the lifeblood, according to several organizations, of their organizations. They support their bottom line, they support their fundraising efforts, and they're meant to destroy these farm families' way of life.
I wanted to ask you, it's interesting when you look at the initial charges against Amy Meyer, for example, who was charged, then the charges were dropped earlier after that, but the question of interference comes up, the word interference. In what way do videos like this interfere with the operation of a family farm or of an industry or of a company? I mean, beyond it just being graphic and difficult to see for some of these things, in what way do they interfere with the actual operation of these farms?
Well, I think we really need to think about security. The farms that I've toured, they go to great lengths to make sure that the food supply in this country is safe, which I think that most people would agree is very important. So when you have someone that's coming onto a farm or onto a ranch or into a processing facility that is filling out paperwork, that is misrepresenting why they're there, who they are in most cases. These undercover agents use false names, false identities. They're really not there to do the job that they're hired to do. What they're there to do is to take footage. And they're presenting something that is false, and they're on those farms or ranches for under false pretenses. So I think we have to worry about security. There's a lot of facilities where you're required to shower in and shower out before you're on the farm so that you don't bring any sort of diseases onto the farm and transmit those to the animals. So there's an element there that if you have someone there that you don't know why they're there or they're covering up their true reason for being there, you need to worry about security. You would never want anything to enter the food supply that is not supposed to be there. So that's where these videos become very disruptive, because you have these agents who have these orders from these organizations to go in and get hired on these farms and obtain footage. And then when they get what they want, or, in most cases, if they don't get what they want, they still produce a video with a false narrative. But they're there for weeks or months, and they're representing they're there for one reason, and they're really there for another. And so I think there's a big element of security, and that's what this legislation is talking about when you're talking about disrupting the operation of the farm, is we want to make sure our food supply in this country is as safe as it can be, and that the people that are working with animals and that are working with our food supply are there for the right reasons and are there to do the job they were hired to do within the specifications of that job.
Now, you've heard this from Will Potter, and I wanted to give you a chance to respond to it. You're talking about food safety, public health. I mean, he mentions this. The largest meat recall in U.S. history came from the secret taping of weak and sick cows being forklifted into these positions in a slaughterhouse in Southern California. How do you respond to that? That there are that some of these people who are out, activists or journalists who are videotaping some abuse, to be sure, is having an effect on public health, because there was, again, a 43 million pounds of meat was recalled. Federal laws against so-called downer cows were tightened. I mean, that seems to have been a positive thing. But don't you see it that way?
Well, I think there's a lot of issues subsumed in that question. Number one, I want to again emphasize that, you know, it was a class 2 recall. So while there was risk to public health, that was very minimal risk. Otherwise, it would have been a class 1 recall. Number two, I think this is a larger point, which is that if those activists that were in the Hallmark Westland plant in California had reported that abuse that they saw to management that much sooner, what could have been accomplished? Or they had even reported it to the local authorities. Every state in this country has animal cruelty laws, which are strictly enforced. And the Animal Agriculture Alliance has been, we just recently had our national convention, and we had some experts there who were actually at Hallmark Westland, who were at the Department of Agriculture at the time that that happened, and both of them learned about those abuses when that video was released to the Washington Post. And so I think, you know, if you're examining, these activists are really saying, we care about public health, we care about animal welfare. If you care about those things, why are you waiting to report abuse allegations or any sort of allegations? Why are you waiting even a second? In my mind, if you truly are caring about animal welfare, you're seeing something, you're saying something, and you're putting an end to it immediately. And that is not what is happening. What is happening is these videos are being made, they're being held, and they're being released by these organizations as part of fundraising or political campaigns to really better their organizations and not to better public health or animal welfare.
You hear from Will Potter and others that what's motivating this legislation is this group ALEC that we've been the American Legislative Exchange Council. But you've also talked about Emily Meredith, the fact that the initial bill, some of the first ones anyway, was written at a kitchen table, that it had more meager beginnings than that.
That's true. You know, I think it's funny to ALEC, because they get either the credit or the blame for this legislation, depending on, you know, which side you talk to. And in reality, they had nothing to do with it. They don't have a sample bill, contrary to what, you know, Will Potter has to say or anyone else has to say. And in fact, that is true what you just said, and I've said that before. The bill in Iowa was written by, in large part, by Representative Annette Sweeney, who was approached by other farm families saying, you know, what's our recourse here? Because you're not just talking about videos that document abuse. You know, I no one in the industry, myself included, can deny that some, you know, there are bad actors, there are bad apples in every industry, you know, agriculture included. But a lot of these videos are really documenting practices that have been approved by the experts in the industry as being humane and as being safe. And they're documenting those practices, they're releasing them on videos, but they're presenting them with a false narrative. And these videos are really meant to shock and awe the consumer. And so these farm families came together and said, what's our recourse against this? What recourse do we have? Because they're smearing the, you know, American farm family by presenting this misinformation and by promulgating this fear to the consumer, and we need a recourse to protect ourselves against that. And so Annette Sweeney got together with other like-minded legislators, and they wrote the bill in Iowa that would later pass. And I think that's a great example of where legislators came together and recognized the importance of agriculture to not only their state economy, but to our nation's economy. You know, our farm families in this country, they feed the nation, but they also feed the world. And that's something that's very important. And this legislation protects those farm families against these activist groups that seek to destroy their way of life.
I wonder if mainstream Americans saw how their food was processed, not by those who abuse animals, but if they saw how animals were killed, would that have an effect on the industry? Does the industry worry at all about people seeing graphic images of animals being killed as a matter of course in the process? And is the industry interested in protecting consumers from that, those kinds of images, because they are sort of taken out of context or they're difficult to see?
I think that's an excellent question. You know, a lot of the rhetoric we hear is that, you know, that this legislation is meant to protect people who have something to hide. You know, in fact, this legislation is meant to protect those farm families and those farmers and ranchers who do the right thing, but that want to make sure that there's not misinformation being spread about their industry. There's an interesting project that the American Meat Institute just did called the Glass Walls Project, and they have done videos in a beef and a pork slaughterhouse that have been narrated by Dr. Temple Grandin. And Janet Riley with the American Meat Institute said of those videos, again at our national convention, that, you know, if I saw heart surgery, open heart surgery, I wouldn't be able to tell if it was the most brilliant surgeon out there or if it was medical malpractice. And I think that's important because consumers need some context. I don't think the industry is afraid of showing consumers how their food is really produced. What they're afraid of is false narratives and misinformation being spread about the industry. So these videos go a long way to increasing some of that transparency and giving consumers a glimpse of how their food is produced with an expert who can give them that context, give them that background information so they understand what images they're being shown, what's happening, and really that their food supply is safe and that the animals are treated humanely all the way up until slaughter. So I think those videos are a perfect example of how the industry is trying to do better to communicate and trying to do better to reach out to the consumer and address their concerns. And so I would just say, you know, to urge consumers to go to the source. If you're curious about your food supply, you want to know how your food is being produced, come to organizations like the Animal Agriculture Alliance and others out there. Go to the source. Go to your farmer and ask them the questions you have. Don't trust the perspective that are out there by the activist community who doesn't want animals to be used for food production in the country, because their version of the truth is not truthful. And so I urge consumers to go to the source, and the industry in that sense is going to continue to do better to communicate to consumers and address their concerns.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. John has been waiting in Salt Lake. John, welcome.
Yes, I wanted to know if there was an organization that could tell us exactly what was going on, who we should buy from and who we shouldn't. Now, I would have trusted the answer from your first guest. Your second guest, I don't trust the answer from at all.
Okay, Emily Meredith, well, to that question, I suppose you have one answer and Will Potter may have another answer, but let me ask you, since you're on with us now, this idea of how you go to, are there organizations who collect this kind of, even within the industry itself, that collect, for example, instances of abuse from their other members of the industry, for example?
Well, I think, again, that idea that this abuse is widespread is just false in and of itself. You know, there's been many instances where activist groups have released these videos, and there's been a panel that's been put together by industry members and including renowned expert Dr. Temple Grandin, and they've asked for the full footage from these groups to turn over. You know, some of these groups are in facilities for weeks or months, and so this panel wants to review that entire footage. And the groups have never turned that footage over. So I think what you're getting is a very edited version of a full story. You're not getting the full picture. So that would be the group that would be reviewing the footage and determining whether there is actual, you know, abuse taking place or if this has been edited or manipulated in some way. So, you know, I'm not sure quite how to address our caller's question, and I'm sorry that he doesn't trust my opinion, but I think, again, going back to the idea that abuse is not widespread, that, you know, of course there are bad actors and things happen, but trying to tell consumers that there's a lot of options out there, and these groups are trying to eliminate your consumer choice. So go to the source, go to your grocery store or go to your local farmer's market and ask the questions that you're concerned about, but don't trust the perspective of those out there that are trying to eliminate your consumer choice.
Let me, we're running out of time, so we don't have time to hear from Adam, who is calling from Salt Lake City. But Adam, if you don't mind, let me ask your question for you, because I think it raises an important point. Adam says, since when in the United States have we looked upon censorship to solve misinformation? Isn't there a way, he's asking, for the industry to counter these kinds of videos? And I guess that raises the question, Emily Meredith, are you sure this is these kinds of bills? Are you sure this is the way you want to go? If you want more transparency, isn't it just a problem in terms of the public relations aspect to be proposing bills that some perceive anyway as censorship, that do limit people's ability to gather information? You know, is this the way to go about it, I guess, is the question.
I mean, I of course believe that it is. I think that these, again, I reiterate, the majority of these farmers and ranchers are doing the right thing every day, and they were seeking that recourse against these groups who were really presenting them in a false light, who are trying to make instances of abuse emblematic of the entire industry and are trying to really shock and awe consumers into fearing the meat supply in this country. And these bills are a way to prevent these activists from going undercover, you know, and I mentioned the security issue before, that's a real concern, and from misrepresenting themselves to obtain this video footage and to leave the raising of animals for food consumption into the hands of experts like veterinarians, ethicists, behaviorists, people that really have worked with animals day in, day out for generations, and leaving our food supply in their hands and leaving decision making up to those people. And I think that while it's an uphill battle maybe in a PR sense in trying to get people to understand the true impetus for this legislation, I think we need to look at the activist group's agenda rather than looking at the legislation itself. Because I think if you really dig deep there, you'll see that these undercover videos are really meant to end the industry and to bring about the end of the industry. And that's what we need to focus on, is their agenda and not this legislation.
Emily Meredith, she's communications director at the Animal Agricultural Alliance, joined us from her office in Washington, D.C. Emily, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
We invite you to go to our website and you can comment further, join the discussion about this issue. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.